Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Pablo Casals. That's him playing his cello. He's one of the great musicians of the 20th century and best remembered perhaps for his recordings of the Bach cello suites. Now, what stands out in particular is his mastery of the controlled vibrato, a movement of the finger on the string, and it's said to sweeten the note. Now, the way Casals plays vibrato is unique and beautiful and different from other equally talented musicians. But how is it? When you listen, you know, you can't quite put your finger on that difference. But what if you could quantify the difference using physics and math? Well, that's just what my next guests did. Joining me to discuss how to quantify the beauty of vibrato are Elaine Chu, Professor of Digital Media at the Center for Digital Music, and Khalid Rajab, Assistant Professor of Electrical Engineering at Queen Mary University of London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Hi, Ira.
Thanks for joining us. I want to tell our listeners that if you want to see vibrato visualized with math, to go to our website at sciencefriday.com/strings. And I want to ask everybody, do you play the music yourself? Are you eager to analyze your own vibrato skills or some other musical element? Do you want to dissect with math? Give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Elaine, as a musician yourself, give us a layman's explanation of what vibrato is.
Well, vibrato is an oscillation of a tone. So if a tone is just played directly without any elaboration, it's just a flat tone, and it just sounds very plain and simple. But when you add vibrato, it adds a richness to the tone, and it adds another dimension of expressivity that the performer can control and shape and therefore influence the listener's emotion response.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know one of the goals of this project was to analyze the difference between the vibrato on the arhu and a Western instrument like a cello or a violin. And we have a couple of sound samples. Let me play them first for us. First, the vibrato on a cello. Quite beautiful. Now vibrato on the Chinese stringed instrument, the arhu. Wow, that's beautiful too. Khalid, what does the math of quantum physics have to do with music and specifically vibrato? How do you use it?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Let's talk about how you use
how you use
quantum physics to analyze the music.
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. And first of all, I'll say that I have very little musical background myself. So I played a bit of piano when I was in school, but we can all appreciate the beauty of music. But I was really a lot more on the maths and the physics side of things. For me, if I'm looking at it from the perspective of mathematics, music is, it has a signal. So we can look at the audio, the amplitude, how loud it is, and you know how the pitch changes with time. And we can use very similar techniques, whether we're studying, you know, physics, quantum mechanics, electromagnetics, or anything like that. And, you know, that's where my background sort of came into it. So I was looking at basically the, you know, oscillations of atoms. If we blast an atom with a magnetic field, we can, you know, it creates a resonance, so it's going to start vibrating at one particular frequency. And those resonances are similar to what we get, you know, what defines the pitch of music. So if we've got a different note, or, you know, a vibrato is a frequency that's changing with time, it's oscillating. So essentially we were using techniques that were developed for, you know, quantum mechanics, quantum dynamics, and applying those same techniques to look at different sorts of signals. So instead of quantum signals, we were looking at musical signals. Although I have to say, I mean, from my perspective, I found it's a lot more difficult to analyze the musical side of things than the quantum mechanics, just because I feel like you have so much more complexity just that's input by the artist, by the musician, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Chu, using all of these quantum physics tricks, what were you able to find out about the vibrato?
Well, first of all, we also need to credit the PhD student who did sort of a lot of the heavy lifting for this work. His name is Lu-Wei Yang.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, actually, he ran a lot of the experiments and found that the vibrato, the qualities of vibratos on the erhu were extremely different from the ones from violin. And initially, we were studying the same piece of music when it's performed on a violin versus on an erhu. And the piece was originally written for erhu, and so it has a very characteristic Chinese folksy sound. And when played on the violin tries to emulate that kind of folksy Chinese sound, and it gets close, but it's not quite it. And so he was able to extract exactly just how much wider the vibratos were they faster, were they slower, so the vibrato rates. Also looking at the shapes of the vibratos, whether they were shaped with one or two humps, whether it got wider and then narrower and then wider and narrower again. And so it was found that actually it is true that the erhu, if you listen to it, the vibrato is much wider than on a violin. Huh. And part of the reason is because the violin, the instrument itself, has some physical constraints.
Dr. Chu, take a drink of water. Go ahead. No need for you to cough your way through this. Let me ask Khalid to follow up. You know, it sounds very easy for our ears to hear the difference, right? I mean, between the two, we know immediately. Why is it such a challenge for a machine to do that?
That's.
Are you there?
Hello.
Yes.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Can you hear me again?
Yes.
Yeah, I was saying at a very basic level, we've got a pitch which is sort of like the frequency of the note we're playing. So you've got a frequency which represents, say, an A or a B or a C, C sharp, so on. And we can look at that pitch, and the computer can, you know, tell from that pitch what notes we're playing. But it turns out that the notes can be a lot more complicated than that. And Elaine can actually tell you a lot more about this than I can. At a fundamental level, we've got not just the first frequency of the note, but we have a lot more complexity or richness to the note. So we have, you know, the first frequency, but we have many other harmonics after that. And for the computer, it's difficult, first of all, to pick out that frequency quickly enough so that it can analyze it in real time, but also to distinguish which is the correct frequency and you know, which frequencies are important, you know, what which frequencies are going to sort of trigger an emotion in us.
Elaine, could we potentially unlock the secrets of the masters like Pablo Casals using tools like this?
Well, we're hoping that we can do that. because the way that Pablo Casals uses vibrato is probably very different from another cellist, say Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah.
And using these tools, we can not just listen to the quality of the vibrato, we can actually objectively quantify them. And if we're able to objectively quantify them, we can compare them next to each other. In a sense, we can freeze them in time and look at the parameters that the artists evoke as they shape the vibratos. And in so doing, we've taken something that is very much felt by listeners and turned it into something that is not just about feeling, but we can actually see the shapes, we can actually quantify the parameters, and we can compare them with numbers, with mathematics.
Mm-hmm. And Khaled, I only have about a minute or two left, but I know I have to ask you this question. I can't let you go without asking.
Yeah.
I understand you work on something any Harry Potter fan would love, and that is an invisibility cloak. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of my background is working in electromagnetics, so light or radio waves. And something I'd been working on previously was it's called metamaterials, or so it's basically designing materials to behave how we want them to behave. And sometimes this can be in quite an unnatural way. So one thing that we've looked at is ways to design materials so they could bend the light around objects, hence making them invisible.
And so this has to do with resonance also.
Yeah, it is. And that it can get very complicated within the structures because you've got so many different materials that you'll basically design to resonate at different frequencies. And that opens up a whole host of problems, which, you know, scientists and engineers have to work on.
Well, we had a whole host of problems today, so that's a good way. Thank you all for bearing with us.
The nature of international tools.
It is. It's a perfect storm. Elaine Chu, professor of digital media at the Center for Digital Music, and Khaled Rajab, assistant professor of electrical engineering at Queen Mary University of London. And you can check out our sound samples that we've been playing and see for yourself. We're going to take a break, and coming up, the weather satellites we have to thank for alerting us to this week's snowstorm. What might happen if they break? Scientists actually thinking about creating robots that might go up and fix the weather satellites. And you know how important the weather satellites are. Wink, winks. We'll be right with you. Stay with us after this break.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jerry Seinfeld on making a life in comedy.
This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. Any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Jerry Seinfeld on his film Unfrosted and more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As you know, Mother Nature delivered a mid-March blizzard to those of us in the Northeast this week and those of us trying to get back to the Northeast this week, dumping up to 2 feet of snow in some places. But while it might have been unusual for this time of the year, the storm was not actually surprising. 1 week earlier, weather satellites run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, you know it as NOAA, began tracking two low-pressure systems whose paths were on a collision course. So when these two systems came together to create one giant low-pressure snow monster, most people were ready. And whether we know it or not, we rely on information from satellites in low Earth and geostationary orbit every day. We have weather, cell phones, stuff like that. So what if something up there breaks? You know, we can't in most cases just send up a repair person and make a house call. You can't do anything about it except use another satellite or send up a new one. And, you know, that costs hundreds of millions of dollars, which is why scientists are looking into whether it's time we built something that could fix a satellite, like a robotic repairman. Joining me to talk about these important weather instruments and what it would take to give them their own AAA mechanic, so to speak, are my next guests. Steve Oldham is a senior vice president for strategic business development at SSL, which build satellites at Space Systems, Laurel, and Michael Stringer, Assistant System Program Director for the GOES-R satellites at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. And Noah, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Michael, so what weather satellites are we working with right now?
So NOAA has and operates polar satellites that go from pole to pole, circling the planet approximately 14 times a day, and the Earth is then rotating underneath. So we see the entire planet, and those satellites allow for global forecasting to predict the weather out into a week or more in advance. Then we have the geostationary satellites, which is the program I'm on, that stays over the same point of the Earth. And so the satellite's out at 22,300 miles, and it orbits at a speed that stays over the same point. So we can constantly be looking at the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. So that's its orbit is going at the same rate that the Earth turns, so it appears to be staying in the same spot, but it's synchronized.
Correct.
And how long have these satellites been up there?
We've been operating satellites up there for over 40 years, and especially at the geostationary ones. And so the GOES-R series is the fifth generation of GOES satellites.
And last November, NOAA sent up GOES-16 with all kinds of new features, sort of like a new version of the iPhone. What can the GOES-16 do better than our current satellites?
So the GOES-16 is a total weather satellite looking at the sun and its weather, looking at space weather right around the spacecraft, and most importantly, looking at the Earth weather with two main sensors. One is our Advanced Baseline Imager, which is three times more spectrum or different color bands than the current satellites. It has four times the resolution of the current satellites, and it's five times faster.
I want one
of
these.
And then the other instrument, and then the other instrument is a geostationary lightning mapper, so we can now watch the lightning from geostationary.
Now there are things that do stop working on the satellites, right? I mean, right now we have satellites that have parts that are not working, but they have spare parts that back them up.
Correct. We build our satellites with redundancy in the different parts so that if one part fails, we still have backup parts. And that we also right now have on the operational side, the legacy satellites, we have three that are ready for operations. We have an east satellite, a west satellite, and a satellite that's in a on-orbit storage position. So then in case there would be an issue with one of the operating east or west satellites, we could move the storage satellite into position rather quickly.
Yeah. Now, Steve Oldham, it seems quite relevant and quite clear here that we really need these satellites and we need to have them working all the time. Why haven't we looked into repairing satellites in orbit before? Why now?
Yeah, it's a great question. We tend to forget that space is the invisible infrastructure that we're all critically dependent on. It's not just weather, it's communications. We have an expectation of a cell phone signal wherever we go, of connectivity anywhere on the planet, of excellent weather forecasting like NOAA provide. But space is providing that. And space works on a throwaway culture. So right now we build a satellite. It goes a long way up in the air. It lasts a long period of time. We design them as well as we can. As Michael was mentioning, they're designed to be redundant and have the ability to fail safe. But problems occur. They occur all the time. Satellites can go into the wrong orbit. They can have antenna failures, deployment failures. And we don't service them. And, if you think of any other element of our infrastructure, our traffic systems, our water systems, sewage, power, the idea of not servicing on a regular basis these things really makes no sense. So the reason we don't is because the technology to date hasn't existed, and that's what we're now working on.
You're working on with DARPA on building a satellite that could go up and repair other satellites?
Yeah, there are a couple of programs that that have been instigated over the last few months. So NASA is developing a program that will refuel, put more fuel into low-Earth orbiting satellites called RESTORE. And DARPA is producing an advanced system that will allow not just repair and life extension, but also assembly and augmentation of satellites in space. And SSL, which is, for those people who don't know SSL, we're in Palo Alto, California, and we export more satellites worldwide than any other American company. And we are the partners of both NASA and DARPA on those two programs.
Wow, there's a free plug for you guys. I guess, you know, being a handy guy myself, I repair little things around the house. I know that you have to have, to repair something, it has to be made so you can repair it, right? So you can take it apart easily and replace the part that's going bad. Are the satellites, the weather satellites that are up there now, are they built so that they can be repaired? I mean, if you're going to send up a repair truck or whatever, a robot, you have to be able to get the parts out and put the new ones in, don't you?
So it's a two-step process. The satellites that are up there today in both GEO and LEO, we can rendezvous with them, by which I mean we can fly up to them and connect with them, and we can do certain operations. We can extend life. We can do literally the same as you do with your car when you fill it up at the gas station, unscrew the fuel cap and pour more gas in. We can do certain amounts of repair. If an antenna is stuck, if it didn't deploy properly, for example, we can fix that. In the future, I expect to see satellites that are built like our laptops, where you have the equivalent of a USB port, and you assemble the satellite using the USB port, you plug parts in. Later on, if a part fails, you pull that one out, you plug another one in.
And that's what you need. What would it take, Michael, to build a satellite that could be taken apart easily and put back together in orbit?
Well, what we would like to see is, demonstrations like that Steve's looking at, where we would see how those would work, and then we would investigate that in the future to see how we would build those new satellites.
Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of a chicken or egg thing here. You go up now and see if you can repair them or parts of them, and then see what you have to do in the future to make it easier.
Right. Yeah, satellites would have to be made, like Steve said, more modular to be able to do it. The new series does not have that modularity. Yeah. So there's only limited things they could do.
Well, looking at the new budget that the president has put out for various science projects and the weather, and having people in Congress, I remember famously when Jane Lubchenco, when she was head of NOAA, was asked by a congressman why we need weather satellites when you can get all your weather from the Weather Channel. I mean, does Congress have any idea about how the weather satellites work? No one wants to touch that one.
I was going to say, we are constantly briefing Congress about our satellites and about our progress and giving them the updated information about how well GO-16 is doing and how much more details it can see, and how we were monitoring the storm this last week and what was happening with that, and all the advances in that we're going to be able to get out of this new technology.
But I was a serious question. When you're looking and you look at new, budget figures, is NOAA a high priority, especially to build new weather satellites?
Well, I'm not the one to talk about the budget process. I'm not really in that part of it. We can get you the names of folks that are the appropriate people to talk about the budgets.
I shouldn't have asked you to answer a question outside of your pay grade, which is how they say it in Washington. So let me go back to the science and technology here. How much would it cost then to build the satellite repair robot? Is this something that we have to worry about breaking down in orbit too, Steve?
Yeah, so what DARPA are doing on their program is they're doing basically a public-private partnership. And the reason they're doing that, government puts up half the costs and SSL is putting up about half the costs. And it's a multi-hundred-million-dollar activity. Once the satellite is up in orbit, though, it can then move around the geo belt for the next 15 years, doing maintenance operations, life extension operations, inspection, repair, augmentation. And the reason DARPA are doing it that way is because they want the buy-in of the industry. To Michael's point, nobody's going to start building satellites to be modular and assembled in orbit until you know that the capability exists up in space to be able to deal with it. So the best way to ensure that is to choose a commercial partner and have the commercial industry and the government industry both receiving this demonstration and starting to implement it. So we're already at SSL, we're already building satellites that are modular. We have designs for those. We're working with our commercial customers on those. It's an exciting capability, and we're looking forward to demonstrating, the ability to do this plug and play through the DARPA mission.
844-724-8255 is our number. Talking with Michael Stringer, who is Assistant System Program Director at the GOES-R satellite at NOAA. Steve Oldham, Senior Vice President for Strategic Business Development for SSL. If you were going to build a new satellite, Steve, what more tricks? I mean, it takes years, right, to get these things on the drawing boards. Probably the satellite, the new GOES, has probably got stuff that's years old on it. What kind of new things would you want to put into it that you don't have already?
So what we would like to see in the architecture going forward is the idea that instead of building a satellite, you first build a platform.
Mm.
And the platform is, think of it like a shopping mall concept. So you put up your shopping mall, your platform, and then you add to it the capabilities that you want according to market need. So, for example, in the case of Michael's weather satellites, I'm sure NOAA would envisage a certain set of instruments that they want on board initially, and you put those on. Then 3, 4, 5 years later, there's a need for more accurate weather assessment. There's better instruments have been developed. And instead of having to wait a long time for the next satellite, instead you launch just that payload, just the instrument, and you plug it into the outside of your existing platform. And now, instead of, you know, going through this cycle of a large capital expenditure to build a satellite followed by a lengthy period of operations, now NOAA and other users can constantly iterate and get newest technology available much faster.
So you basically want to build a rack-mounted satellite.
Yeah, it's a combination of that concept. And you said it very well, the AAA. You know, we would like to be the AAA of space. It's a great business model and a great capability.
Can't top that line, so I'll give out the ID. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. And you'd be making house calls if you were the AAA. How many satellites? There are tens of thousands of satellites out there now, would you say?
In GEO, there's a smaller number than that. It's probably in the thousand.
Yeah.
In LEO, there's many more. I'm sure you'll have done segments and heard about the small micro and cube satellites that companies like Planet are doing now.
Yeah.
So there's many, many more satellites in LEO. In GEO, it's a lot further away. You need larger satellites, and there's less of them.
Mm-hmm. Michael, how much money do we spend on the weather satellite program now?
So the GOES-R satellite program, which is from the early 2000s in the concept development and the instruments and planning all that out, through building four satellites. We're building four, so GOES-16 was just our first one. We're going to be launching GOES-17 just a little under a year from now, and then we have two more after that. And then we'll operate those out to 2036, and that total cost was $10.8 billion.
Now, that's got to be a lot less than what you would pay for a storm, whether it's a natural disaster like a hurricane or the snowstorms that we just had or something like that. By having this satellite, even though it sounds like a lot of money, you're saving money in the long run.
Right. So every year there are multiple billion-dollar events that happen that are weather-related. And so by NOAA having this valuable infrastructure to get the word out to the public that these events are about to happen, they can take shelter, they can move products into safe locations, and FEMA can stand up and be ready to support those rescue operations by pre-deploying to a safe area just before the storm, and as soon as the storm clears, they can be ready to move in.
Let me go to a quick question from Richard in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi there. Welcome.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be on. My question was regarding the comment earlier about the commercial satellites. When I turn on a local weather channel or I turn on my local Comcast station, is the imagery that I'm seeing, is that NOAA imagery or is that coming from a commercial product? Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's NOAA imagery, often enhanced by the commercial vendors. They take our NOAA data. And then when we have the 16 different channels, which is different color channels and IR, and they can take that information and blend it together in different ways to give enhancements to that before it comes out onto the TV broadcast.
How do you work with the NASA weather satellites? Are you integrated with them at all?
So we're actually in partnership. It's a joint, the GOES-R program is a joint NOAA-NASA program. And so we work very closely with NASA on building these satellites.
And then also the information that comes out is available to both of you.
Yes.
Quite fascinating. I think we got a primer on everything you wanted to know about the weather satellites today. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Steve Oldham, Senior Vice President for Strategic Business Development at SSL, which builds all those satellites. Michael Stringer, Assistant System Program Director for GOES-R Satellites at NOAA. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Ira.
Thank you. Coming up, what's the best story you have ever heard? Whatever it is, my next guest thinks he has a better one. We're going to talk about the quest to understand the universe and a physicist's answer to why are we here? Lawrence Krauss. Physicist Lawrence Krauss joins us. We're going to talk about physics and talk about, you know, a little bit of budgets for science. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Why are we here? Or rather, how? The answer, of course, will depend on whom you ask. A biologist will give you one answer. Ask a physicist, though, and you might hear something about the Higgs boson, how it gives us mass under the Standard Model of Physics. My next guest thinks a lot about how the universe came to be and how it might end, and what we still don't know about both of these questions. Lawrence Krauss is a theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. He is author of The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, out at the end of the month, and he's an old friend of Science Friday. Welcome back, Lawrence.
It's always good to be back, Ira.
Thank you. That is a provocative title, especially the so far. What makes modern physics such a great story so far?
Well, the point is, it's the greatest intellectual journey that humans have ever taken. It's full of surprises, pathos, frustrations, all the aspects that make human stories wonderful. But the really important part, as you just said, is the so far part. Because the greatest part about the greatest story ever told so far is it's getting better all the time. The story of time, science changes. It evolves. It's not like that other supposed greatest story ever told so far, which is sort of static and not even that interesting.
So, you know, and I think that's a lot of what people don't realize. They think, you know, when they hear the word science, it's just an encyclopedic book of everything we know that's sitting on the table. But that is not how science works, is it?
No, in fact, that's the key thing. It's the process of science that's so important. And what this book is, in some sense, is a celebration of that process, how it's taken us. It starts with Plato, but how it's taken us in the last 500 years from just beginning to learn about the laws of motion to understanding that the universe we see is really an illusion. It's really a shadow of reality. And the amazing developments that have taken physicists literally kicking and screaming. Nature dragged us here. It's not as if it was sort of obvious all the way. There's lots of red herrings. Too often we present science not only just as a set of facts instead of a process for deriving those facts, but also as some logical continuum. But it's really, of course, a human activity where oftentimes you can go down a blind alley for an awful long time or even have the answer, but not know you have the answer, which happened in the history of particle physics, certainly in the last 50 years.
You know, and we've talked over the years about physics and discoveries, and you've said many times that it's the joy of not knowing, and that sometimes when physicists find an experiment to be wrong and they don't find something, they're not disappointed, they're even happier.
Sometimes, in fact, I often say the two best states for at least a theorist to be in are wrong and confused, because that means there's more to learn. And oftentimes, in fact, there have been very important experiments that have surprised us, right back from the Michelson-Morley experiment, mm-hmm. where we expected to see the Earth moving in the background of the ether. Experiments surprise us. We expected to see the universe slowing down, and what happened? It was speeding up. And I have to say, even in my case, the experiment surprised us with the Large Hadron Collider. I was betting that the Higgs field didn't exist, that the Higgs particle wouldn't be discovered. It just seemed too slippery a solution. Even though it was really the centerpiece of the Standard Model, I thought nature would come up with a different answer, and it didn't, which certainly surprised me, at least.
So now, does that make you have to reevaluate your ideas?
Of course, and what's wonderful about that is the minute the Higgs was discovered, I began to think of implications that I had never thought of before. It's often, as a theoretical physicist, it's kind of amazing to me how I've written papers after the fact, after a discovery that I could have anticipated before the discovery, but it's somehow when it's real, when the experiment presents it to you, suddenly you start to think of implications in a new way. And that's really what happened. As I say, we often think of sort of physicists as being done, physics as being done by Einstein and other people in a room late at night alone. That's not the way it's done generally. First of all, it's a collaborative enterprise. It's full of lots of individuals. I mean, the Large Hadron Collider is 10,000 physicists from over 100 countries speaking dozens of languages. And as like I say, it's the Gothic cathedral of the 21st century. But it's also often, most often, when it's healthy anyway, being driven by experiment. The experiment forces us to change our ideas. If you locked theoretical physicists in a room and had them come up with a picture of the universe, the picture they'd come up with wouldn't look at all like the universe in which we lived in.
Mm-hmm. Our number, if you'd like to join us, talk to Lawrence Krauss, 844-724-8255, author of The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Is there any new physics that needs to be discovered for us to move forward? Laughing at that question, even before I finished asking.
Well, I think you know the answer. Of course, that's the great thing about science is each time we make a discovery, there are almost more questions than answers. So we discovered the Higgs particle, and it told us, it validated a notion which is so amazing, I have to repeat it. It validated a notion that there's this invisible field everywhere in the universe that affects, that allows us to exist, which, by the way, sounds religious, doesn't it? But the difference is that invisible field that we postulated had to be discovered, and that's what the Large Hadron Collider was about. But the question now is, so we've discovered that that field exists, and we wouldn't be here if it weren't for that. The universe certainly isn't designed for our existence. The fundamental laws, in fact, wouldn't even allow for our existence unless this field had frozen in the early history of the universe and changed the properties of the forces we measure and the particles that make us up. But the next question is, why did it freeze? Why is it there? Why did it freeze and have the value it does? Does it indicate something? In fact, the scale that it froze at is a very unusual scale, because if we think if the three of the four forces in nature unify, it would happen at a very different scale. Why are the scales different? There are tons of questions that arise now that we know it happened. The question, I was going to say why it happened, but really the question is, how did it happen?
And since we talked about the discovery, there have been other discoveries, and since the Higgs, and I'm talking now about gravity waves. I mean, that really...
Yeah, well, of course, gravity, I mean, the discovery of gravity waves is another amazing thing, which, by the way, I would never have thought was possible. I mean, that's the reason I'm a theorist, I suppose. You look at those experiments to measure gravity waves. LIGO had to measure a difference in length between two 4-kilometer-long arms. As the gravity wave comes by, it would cause the length of the two arms to change a little bit. But the amount it would change by is 1/1,000th the size of a proton. I mean, who would have thought you could do that? It's amazing. But what's really neat is that this just opens up. We're like, sort of like Galileo when he turned his telescope up to see the moons of Jupiter. We're entering a new era of astronomy, gravitational wave astronomy, that's going to reveal a whole new window on the universe. And every time we open up new windows, we're surprised. And as far as I'm concerned, probably the most interesting surprise will be when we can measure gravity waves not from colliding black holes, as LIGO did, but in fact, gravitational waves that are created at the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. Because gravitational waves created in the initial moments of the Big Bang can actually make it to us through that dense early universe, and we can actually probe a signal from a time when the universe was a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second old to test the ideas that we're building upon after the discovery of the Higgs. It will allow us to test not just how the universe began, but actually probe particle physics at a scale that's probably 12 orders of magnitude higher in energy than we could ever do with accelerators on the ground. You'd have to have an accelerator whose circumference was the Earth-Moon distance in order to probe the same kind of physics that we may probe with gravity waves from the early universe. It's remarkable.
It's remarkable. And, you know, it's also a remarkable, as you say, an engine. You're a theorist. You don't build the equipment. You just go to the blackboard and talk about it.
Yeah, I just talk.
and you leave it up to the engineers and whatever, the guys who make and women who make the devices, to think that you could build, I mean, that, hearing you talk about the machine, the LIGO itself, how accurate it has to be, that's almost an amazing event in itself. Being able to create.
It's worth celebrating as part of the greatest story ever told so far. It really is a great story. And you know, LIGO's wonderful, but we shouldn't discount the Large Hadron Collider, which is probably even a more complex system in a sense that every second more information is generated in it than in all the world's libraries. It involves a vacuum tunnel that's 26 kilometers long where the vacuum is sparser than the vacuum of empty space. It's amazing to think that humanity has built these incredible devices just to test these ideas about how we got here and where we come from. Directly, they won't make a better toaster. Some people say, why is it worth doing that? And, you know, what will it help us do? And, of course, there are side benefits. CERN produced ultimately the World Wide Web, for example, which we all rely on. But we don't want to. It's not worth funding for those side benefits. It's really answering those fundamental questions that you and I and everyone else has that makes us all scientists in some sense. Why do we get here? How do we get here? What, you know, what, are we alone? All those interesting questions.
Are you fearful that some of the funding for basic science may go away in this new administration?
Absolutely. In the current climate, with the president's budget that's just comes out, for example, cut fundamental funding for the kind of research I'm talking about by 20%. But it's not just that. I'm as concerned about the cuts in science as I am about the cuts in the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, and of course, real relevant for this program, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. These hit the fundamental aspects of our civilization, the things that really make us great. There's a wonderful quote that Robert Wilson, who was the first director of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, a particle accelerator, when he was talking before Congress, he was asked, would it aid in the defense of the nation? And he said, no, but it'll help keep the nation worth defending. And I think that's really worth remembering today in the current climate.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Lots of interesting calls. Let's go to Mike in Houston. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I just want to make a quick comment about the Higgs boson particle. On the news last year, it was somewhat amusing. They said that in an episode of The Simpsons, Homer Simpson had roughly estimated the size of the Higgs boson particle like 10 years ago. Were you aware of that? Did you hear that?
Okay.
No, I didn't see his paper on the subject, actually.
Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. But secondly, with space travel, we use, you know, rocket fuel from the 1950s. What do you think is the next generation of propulsion systems? And do you think particle
We're already using them, I think, to jump in. I mean, Ira may have talked about on this program or others that we're using, for example, electronic propulsion techniques where we're basically using electric fields to propel atoms out the back of a spacecraft very fast. What it does, especially for deep space missions, is it allows those rockets to move faster than they would with just chemical propulsion. So that's certainly one of the new propulsion technologies. And as we look to go deeper and deeper in space, certainly conventional rocket fuel become less and less worthwhile, except to get us out of the Earth, maybe.
Do you foresee us in the near future being able to successfully unitize gravity with, you know, quantum? Are we going to have a gravity?
Yeah, with the other, right now we know three of the four forces in nature. We've discovered them. And by the way, I will jump in and say, often we think of the most exciting decades of the 20th century to be 1905 to 1925 when special and general relativity and quantum mechanics were developed. But part of the reason for this book is there's an unheralded 20 years from 1955 to 1975. At the beginning of that, we understood one force of nature as a quantum theory, electromagnetism. By 1975, we understood three of the four forces in nature exactly as quantum theories. It was just an amazing development and a revolutionary one that I think future historians may think is perhaps one of the most revolutionary periods in the 20th century. But again, right now, as you alluded, there's one force that's still an outlier, and that's gravity. We don't have a quantum theory of gravity. There are ideas, of course, and string theory was developed to hopefully produce such a quantum theory. We don't know if it is, in a sense. We don't know if that it's an interesting idea, but we don't know if it relates to the real world yet. And the answer, of course, Ira, is we don't know. That's what makes discovery so wonderful. Yeah. You know, people always ask me, you know, what's the next big development? And I always say, if I knew, I'd be doing it.
All right. Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Lawrence Krauss, director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and author of The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Another great book, Lawrence, in the series of books that you have continued.
Thank
to.
Thank you. I'm very pleased with this book. You know, every book I learn something new, and I'm often surprised. In this case, the story which I began to delve in, I knew the physics, but the actual history of it turned out to be far more interesting than I imagined. And the fact when you see these people and the great scientists that I discuss, they almost getting the right solution 10 or 20 years before it came out. And you just want to shake them and say, just look over here, and you've got it all right there. It's kind of amazing. In retrospect, of course, things are always clearer in hindsight.
That's Monday morning quarterbacking, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go to the phone, see if we can get a couple of calls in here. Let's go to Damascus, Maryland. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday. Patrick.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So, Lawrence, I had a question for you. I had a few, but I think I'll stick to one. I was wondering if it was, if in your mind you felt that it may be a bit of a misnomer to call the laws of physics or nature laws as opposed to properties.
Well, where, you know, why?
Well, I was saying, whereas the laws feel like they constrain matter and energy, and then properties seems like it emanates from matter and energy.
Well,
Explain what a law of physics is. What does that mean by a law of physics?
Well, it's good. It's a really good question in general. And a law of physics is basically, it does constrain things. That's why it's well named. In physics, we really can't say what's possible. We can really say effectively what's impossible because we do experiments that rule out ideas. And even the ideas that survive may not be all the ideas. So a law of physics is something that basically is a theory that's been tested by experiments. And a law that we find that every experiment tells us is not violated. And moreover, we have very sound theoretical reasons for understanding. Let me give you an example. And it's really important because it points to some of the ways we don't teach science correctly in schools. Often we tell kids, well, there's a law of conservation of energy and a law of conservation of momentum. And it sounds like, you know, that comes from the Ten Commandments or something, that we just wrote it down and said, this is the way it is. But we now understand that these laws derive from fundamental symmetries of nature. The reason energy is conserved is that's equivalent to saying the laws of physics don't change with time, which we measure every day, and it's really important. If laws of physics did change with time, you'd have to take a different introductory physics class every year, and people would really hate that. The law of conservation of momentum comes from the fact that the laws of physics don't change from point to point. These are fundamental aspects of the universe that are highly unlikely to change, and that's why we have such great confidence that those laws ultimately do constrain any new theory, and any new theory will have to accommodate those facts. And if it doesn't, it will have to explain in some sense how the laws of physics change from place to place or from time to time.
Lawrence, wish we had more time. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ira. I wish we had more time, too. I'll come back sometime.
We'll have you back. Lawrence Krauss, Foundation Professor and Director of the Origins Project, Arizona State University in Tempe, author of The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, out next month on Atria Books. Thanks again. Have a good weekend, Lawrence. One last thing before we go, a special shout-out to our listeners in Florida. In just 11 days, Science Friday will be on stage at the Bob Carr Theater in Orlando. We'll be talking about bionic arms, Navy missile decoys, NASA robots that can mine the moon. And yes, there will be robot demos on stage. I don't know, maybe we'll have a battle of the bots. Not promising, but the robots will be there. Who knows what could happen. Tickets are selling fast, so grab yours at sciencefriday.com/Orlando. That's sciencefriday.com/Orlando, 11 days from now on the stage at the Bob Carr Theater in Orlando. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great St. Patrick's Day. Happy weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.